At Her Spirit, we're here for you. We want to help you discover your potential, achieve your goals, ignite your fitness, find your community. Head to herspirit.co.uk and sign up for our core membership. Get access to our virtual classes, monthly challenges, expert advice, and track your progress in our health hub. You'll also find your very own cheerleading squad who will support you every step of the way. Use the code HERSPIRITPOD3 and get 3 months completely free. It's time for you.
Addie Emerson is an absolute number, everyone. Welcome to our Her Spirit podcast, Christmas review of the year. And I'm laughing because I said in the last podcast I was going to get glitter and I've given myself like a tinsel halo. And Annie, guess what? Comes on with a beautiful Christmas hat, which I'm already jealous. And then the most brilliant tinsel, red tinsel, nonchalantly thrown around your neck. Oh, Annie, you're making me feel all Christmassy. It's lovely.
I mean, I do feel Christmassy. And I have to admit to being a bit of a humbug sometimes about Christmas. I sit in that place where you go, oh, some of it's brilliant and some of it's not so great because some people don't have so much stuff. But anyway, children are brilliant because children come in and just make you kind of get real about stuff. And the reason I got tinsel is until I had children, I'd put a ban on tinsel because obviously tinsel's old fashioned. And I like a tree that's kind of quite adult-like. But now with the children, they insist I buy lots of tinsel. So that's why I've got this beautiful red tinsel scarf on, Lou.
My tree has been up since November.
It has not.
Literally, it has, I promise you.
Is it a real tree?
Yeah, it is a real tree. It's holding up. I don't think it's going to make it till... I don't know when it's going to make it until. But it's looking lovely at the moment.
No, it's not going to make it. But it's going to be, it'll be a bit yellow and a bit droopy by Christmas Day. You'll need a new one.
Well, maybe, I don't know what I'm going to do, Annie, but I just had to have something to cheer me up. Now, listen, you mentioned Christmas and being humbug. You are doing something which is impressive. Come on, tell us what it is.
Well, I don't know about impressive.
It is.
I guess I do like a challenge. I do, because I think I don't, but actually, of course I do. So I used to do, with my twin sister years ago before I had kids, used to do a few days at crisis shelters every year. And this year, I was just like, it's such a hard year for everyone. We know that. For so many people will be having a difficult time. There's going to be a lot of families out there struggling and, you know, that's a really horrible thought. But I guess the charity crisis is, you know, quite close to my heart, having done some work for them previously. And I thought, God, what's worse than not having food? And that is a roof over your head. So I've decided that I'm going to do a little challenge. It's the Arctic Ultra Virtual Challenge.
Right.
And it's 160 kilometres. You're allowed to do it throughout the whole month of December. So you could swim, bike, run, row, whatever.
Yeah, but that would be too easy, Annie, wouldn't it? For you.
I thought that's ridiculous. And then I thought about doing base camp, which is 130 kilometres. And then I thought of my friend Louise, who did 160K, brilliant charity ride for the big bike in way back. When was it? In the summer. And I thought, how am I going to do a kilometre less than what she did? So I've set myself the challenge of doing the Arctic Ultra virtual challenge on a stationary bike. In one sitting. Why not?
And it's what, 100? So it's 160 kilometres. So
yes.
It's 100 and something miles then, isn't it? Wow, Annie, this is great. And you, at the beginning of this podcast, life in lockdown, etc., you didn't bike inside, did you?
My life has changed. My life has changed.
It has, hasn't it?
Well, I didn't ride at all. I haven't ridden for about 14 years. So I retired from triathlon in 2006, decided I never really wanted to ride again. I'd done my time on a bike and I love my running. And then a few things happened and I found myself in possession of a very nice bike.
And then you started riding. And you've loved it.
You also G'd me up big time with your big bike in because, yes, because I realised that probably out of the three sports, the biking is probably my most natural sport for me. And I hadn't ridden, I don't think I'd done anything proper for nearly 14 years when we did the big bike in or when I joined you for half of it and I sat on a bike for 80K. And I thought, if I can do 80K on nothing, I can probably do quite a bit more. And I started enjoying it. And actually, the biking's great for, it's a bit vanity, if I'm really honest with you, Lou. It's good for the bum and the hamstrings.
Well, Annie, honestly, I see pictures of you on your bike and I just go, my gosh, he's so strong. So on the last, I think 17th of December is the last Her Spirit bike session. So we can dedicate that to you. It's 6:30. I don't know if I'll be allowed to bike by then, but if I am, I might be able to because I think I'm allowed to That's the first thing I'd be allowed to do after my foot operation. I will come and join you for that, and I'll come and join you on the day as well. Because you're going to do it, virtually as well, aren't you? So I'll try if I'm allowed to.
Okay, yeah, and fine. I would love to see you, even if it was for half an hour.
Whatever, I'll see what I can do. And I know lots of people will join you, and I will sponsor you at least. We'll share the link. So our review of the year. You've changed. Lots of the people I've talked to have changed my view on things as well. In this review, we're going to talk about various people, including Stacey Copeland. Now, she's a boxer. And, you know, we've talked about so many different sports, haven't we, during the whole of the podcast. And I just was so impressed by her mental attitude, her resilience, and also that whole thing about, you know, she's making her way in what you assume is a man's world, which I think in some ways it still is. But how absolutely fantastic she was, and the sheer kind of like determined guts that she has were just exceptional.
An amazing human being. Another thing that I really picked up on was her sense of kind of giving back to the community, Louise. And I think that's a really powerful thing, because I think that in itself enriches her as much as her training and her boxing results and all that she does, the importance of giving back to community. And I just loved everything about her. Yeah. Great.
She was great, wasn't she? We also talked to Naga Manchetti, who of course is one of my colleagues on BBC Breakfast. And I really, I found so much of that really so, there was so much insight into herself, wasn't there? And she's quite different. I mean, anybody who watches on the telly will realise, but she's got a hugely kind of, I admire her self-confidence.
Do you know what? I love it. And I think, you know, these days we're not supposed to big ourselves up, are we? We're all supposed to be very humble and actually, you know, she's a great human being. But I love the way she says, you know what? Sorry, I am very bright. I was very academic at school. That's the way I am. And if she believes in something, she fights for it. And actually, she doesn't worry about what other people think. And that's something I always say to my children, you know, unless you should be worried. Don't stress about what other people think, because not everyone is always going to agree with you. And she holds her head up high and says, this is what I believe in. If you don't like it, stuff it. And God, I take my hat off to that. I really do.
There was one line that particularly stayed with me about talking about another guest. And we both wanted this guest on because I've known her for ages, Helen Skelton. I first knew her as a Blue Peter presenter. And she was always so kind of gutsy and feisty when she did that. And then she went on, what was it called? Was it Celebrity SAS?
Yeah.
Who Dares Wins. And she was so impressive. And we were both had a conversation. We were like, right, we need Helen on the podcast.
Yeah, and you and I both spoke about the way the contestants have to deal with the ex-SAS guys and the way they're shouted at. And you and I both said, no, we'd be out on day one. We wouldn't be taking any of that. And she had this ability, and it makes my skin go all goosebumpy to be able to just stand there and with a little smile on her face going, throw at me whatever you like. I'm going to take it all. But the other thing about her that we found out was the challenges that she'd achieved. Oh my God.
What was it? Rowing down the Amazon?
Single-handedly. Like, I mean, just, cause you speak to this sort of girl who's bubbly, gorgeous, funny. Oh, but it goes far deeper than that. It really does. She's a great person.
And I love the way that she trained for the SAS program by carrying her sons on her back, which was brilliant. And my favorite line, maybe my favorite line from the whole of the series was, I don't go to the gym to make my bum feel peachy, it's to make my head feel peachy. Love that line. Because that's so important, isn't it?
Absolutely brilliant. I go to the gym to make my bum peachy and my brain peachy. Can I say that?
You can, but Annie, I think, to be honest with you, if anybody saw you, you wouldn't need to go to the gym. Let's talk about Dame Kelly Holmes, because she is a fantastic, you know, one of our best athletes, and again, gave us a real insight into what had been going on in very difficult times, actually.
Oh, she took my breath away. I mean, I was always a massive fan. I mean, long before I did any sports myself of athletics, and she was one of the athletes that I followed. And when you look back over her athletic career and how close she came to just throwing in the towel, to turning that around and winning two gold medals at the 1500 meter and the 800 meter at the 2004 Athens Olympic Games. Wow. But it didn't stop there, did it, Lou? I mean, it was discussing her childhood, which really kind of brought home what a tough cookie she really is.
Yeah, because she was in a home, wasn't she? And she also talked, didn't she, about, you know, body image again in a very honest way that's really made me kind of sit up and think. Shall we hear from Dame Kelly first?
Let's hear from her.
Sometimes it takes one person in your life to make a difference. And mine was my PE teacher. You know, one person that told me I could actually be good at something at school when everybody else wrote me off and I'm outside the classroom all the time, you know, after talking and not engaging. And that one person, Debbie Page, said to me, you know, get a grip. You can be good at running, but you have to believe it. And, you know, the story says it all. And I remember that and I'll never forget it. And it's exactly the same with the young people that have an athlete speaking to them and working with them over a big period of time who say they've transformed their lives. And that's why I started the Trust.
Well, it's just brilliant. Go on, Annie.
It makes me, like, listening to you speak, Kelly, makes me feel really emotional, because when you think of, you know, Louise and I have kids and, you know, they're pretty lucky, you know, they're pretty spoiled, aren't they, really, at the end of the day. They've got parents they love that love them, you know, they've got good homes, they have everything they want. But, you know, out there are thousands of kids that don't have that. And when we look at what we've been through now with coronavirus, you know, and the things that are important in life and the things that aren't important in life, you know, resilience, health is so important. You know, we've seen that with this virus. And so I love what you're doing and how you talk about, you know, starting right at the bottom, you know, wherever these kids are from, you know, letting them know that, you know, everyone is capable of doing something. You know, very, very few people on this planet aren't, you know. So,
yeah. And you know what? The biggest power I've ever seen, you know, I can big up my charity, you know, I'm president now and started it. But when you see a young person who's been through a journey from a young age, you know, a real big journey where they were totally written off, you know, and these are children who either have parents that are in jail, drugs, alcohol, they're young parents, you know, could be 14, got into a wrong environment, being in prison, maybe home leavers or home carers. When they stand on stage and you've seen them on day one where they've pretty much got that attitude that everyone thinks of them the same as put them in a box. So they come with that attitude, you know, and they have the hoodie up and they grunt and kind of don't really want to be there, some of them. But when you see that at the end and they stand on stage at what we call our go event and they look all smart and they're speaking articulate. And I remember, I never forget this one boy who just stood on stage and said, "This is the start of my life." You know, he'd gone through the program and he said, "This is the start of my life now. I'm going to make it something." And I was like, oh, just crying, you know. Because so it's amazing to see how you can help and transform someone's life if you give them hope and a chance.
I just want to read some of the messages we've had for you as well, Kelly. This is Michelle. She says, "I love that you're so supportive and encouraging of all people at different levels of their health and fitness journey." And this question from Marie, "Thank you for being a great role model. You talk openly about your own mental health and you really have done that for many years, haven't you?" And she asks, "Do you have a toolbox you use to keep the gremlins at bay?" Which is a great question, because I, you know, I've talked a lot in this podcast, haven't I, Annie, about being anxious. And, you know, this has made people, if they're anxious or haven't been anxious, it's a really difficult, has been a difficult time for lots of people.
It really has. And I think it's obviously been made worse now because uncertainty. And we all look at, maybe sometimes we look too far ahead and worry about what's going to happen later on. But most of the time we can only deal with the here and now because we don't have the answers for a month and 2 months right now. So we can set up things that maybe help us through the process. So of course now with lockdown easing, some people are getting back into partly a normality, but it's still not normal life. And we don't know what that's going to look like. So you can only really deal with the here and now. The anxiety thing, I think with a lot of people and also myself, you have to be able to breathe and to kind of recognize what things make you feel good and clearly what doesn't, you know, and identify those. And I think actually this time has probably given people that chance to think about them and who they are, what they like about themselves, maybe what they don't, what they like about the environment they're in and what they don't, you know, because we've been stuck into maybe really weird situations. And, you know, I can't answer for everybody because I know some people have truly struggled through this period for lots of reasons, whether that relationship, like I say, isolation, financial worries, child care problems, whatever it is. And that would have heightened that anxiety. But essentially, it's our life, you know, we have to remember we live this life to live it. You know, why do you want to go through this life, getting to the end of it when you don't know when that end's coming? Never of enjoying yourself, never of having hope, never of actually being happy. So you have to then go, well, if I was lucky enough to live another how many years, what do I want to be like? I don't want to be sad all the time. I don't want to always be anxious and stressed or be depressed. And so one of the things I do this thing called me time. So every single night I go in my bubble bath, I have candles going, have my music tunes going. People are actually giving music choices now. This is how bad it's been. It's been going on for months and months and months, it has. And it doesn't matter whether it's 12 o'clock midnight or 9 o'clock, I'll still do it. And I just feel like if people can find 15 as a minimum minutes of just you, you know, because if you say you're going to go and take your dog out for a walk and get air, that's fine. But if that's a routine, it's not really for you. You're taking the dog out because you have to take the dog out. You know, you haven't really gone, do you know what? I'm going to go out on my own and I'm just going to listen to the birds. I'm going to look at the sky. I'm going to breathe and think. So I say people find that time. And it also, I mean, I'll go into that quickly about my own situation and how an incident changed possibly how I view things. So, I mean, a lot of people know about my journey because I talk about it now, but I had my first massive breakdown in 2003 when I was at the height of my career. And you have to remember, I'd been in the military for nearly 10 years. I'd been an international athlete for 11 years that time. I'm a strong lady. I'm positive, motivated. I'll do everything to reach my full potential. However, being a human being, there's only so much you can take of highs and lows. And when in sport, when extremes are high, something happens to your head, you know, you kind of like, you know, this is like amazing. You just never get that feeling in a lot of situations. But equally, the lows can be so dramatic because of that. And when I again got another niggle, I was 33, I just couldn't cope. Something just broke in me. And I was in a training camp in France. And I lost it. I literally lost it. I looked in the mirror, hated everything, like literally everything about myself, my body, how I looked, who I was, what I did. And I saw some scissors, started to, at that stage, become self-harmer, you know, cutting yourself in places when you've only got a crop top and shorts. There's not many places you cut yourself. But I started doing that and I literally wanted the hole to open up. I wanted to jump in and I did not want to see the next day. But at the same time, you know, I had a dream. I was getting ready for a world championships. I'm in a training camp for a world championships. And I had an Olympic dream and that was the following year. And so at depths of despair, I also won a silver medal at those world championships and no one knew. I didn't have anyone to talk to. I didn't know how to talk to people. I didn't know about depression, breakdown, nothing, you know. So
yeah,
I went through that. And then I think that if anyone's ever had like a really bad knockback, I don't think it ever goes, because I think there has to be some chemical imbalance in your brain that suddenly, like, you know, kind of you feel more susceptible for feeling down and low. And so over the years, you know, I've been retired, 16 years now. I've had ups and downs. I've had other moments. I have self-harm. I've done things. But when my mum passed away in 2017, that was the worst day of my life. Nothing else that I've done myself. And that was the last time also that I self-harmed. It was 2017 because I realised it wasn't going to bring her back and it wasn't helping me. So I had to then decide on what do I do to help myself and how do I never go down to that point of hurting myself as a cry out. So now I use fitness, interacting with people, motivating others helps me. And that's how my therapy works almost.
Oh, I mean, that's just incredible. It's just wonderful. I know you are, have been so honest about it beforehand, but listening to you, honestly, it's really has a massive impact. Do you think, those are really obviously very dark moments. Do you sometimes feel, you know, that you're on that route again and able in some ways to put things in place to stop it?
Yeah. So over the years, I mean, I've got myself down really low. And then one thing I remember, and now I'm a mental health first aider as well and a mental health kind of speaker. One of the things that I don't really live with regrets, but one of the things I would have hoped to have been able to do different, or if time had come again, was to talk to somebody when it was all happening, you know, because the two main ways of supporting your mental health is to communicate, to talk to people, to get that help and to start to, you know, get some of that off your chest and get people to kind of get you out of that phase, and also fitness. And so because I hadn't told anybody, and, you know, all my family and friends read it in my autobiography in 2005, you know, not the great, and in the, you know, the kind of quick newsflash front page about it, and then no one cared about it after that because no one used to talk about it. I just vowed to my friends that if ever I was in that state again, I would make sure that I would talk to them, because they were so upset, because not disappointed with me, but upset that they couldn't have been there for me. So I promised that if I ever, and obviously when my mom passed away, I was like literally broken. 3 weeks, I didn't go out of the house. I'm, you know, such a mess. And they came round, you know, in when you got people close to you, they can make you laugh even though you're so sad, you know, they can do things with you even though you're so sad. And I use that now as a way of, you know, I just tell people, I'm so honest on my social media because I know other people are going through it. And I believe if you can, one, be someone in public eye, but secondly, just be anybody that can be willing to talk, you know, there's somebody else that will resonate with a part of that feeling. And if they, and you see somebody else going through it, it actually makes you feel that you're not alone.
At Her Spirit, we know how powerful women can be. We love your strength, your determination, your compassion. We love the energy that sparks when we connect and spur each other on. Her Spirit was created to ignite that flame of determination, to unleash your energy, to build your self-belief, and to help every woman find a way to your healthiest mind, body, and soul yet. We want to inspire 1 million women just like you to be active, healthy, and happy, because you deserve it. Head to herspirit.co.uk, join our core membership, and use the code HERSPIRITPOD3 to get 3 months completely free. Join our monthly challenges, get access to the Her Spirit Health Hub, and track your activity levels, mood, food, sleep, and stress every single week with your own personalised dashboard. Get expert advice and join daily live classes that can be played back at any time. Plus, find the support that you need to get started and stay motivated. Just sign up at herspirit.co.uk and use the code HERSPIRITPOD3 to get 3 months completely free. It's time for you.
So from Dame Kelly Holmes, who is hugely inspirational, and I'm still, in fact, I'm following everybody, Annie, that we've seen in this, we've talked to in this podcast. I've kind of followed all their journeys onwards. I know she's had an operation. She's also had Corona as well. So she's had tough times since we talked to her. So best of luck to her. So she's one tough cookie. So is Helen Skelton. Okay, I first met the wonderful Helen Skelton, who we're going to speak to in a second, a while back when she was a Blue Beta presenter back in the day. And even then, she was so striking for, first of all, her enthusiasm and her incredible bravery. But the reason why we've asked her on this week is that we've both been addicted to watching SAS Who Dares Wins, which I've been calling DIY SAS, which obviously it isn't. Helen Skelton, you are an incredibly brave woman. Well done.
I tell you what, I'm never going to get out of this building. My head's going to be so big after you two, isn't it? People watch the telly programme and go, oh my days, it's brutal and it's intense. And it is, but it's more intense than it looks because of the mental side. Like for me, I didn't mind the falling backwards out of helicopters. I knew that that would be quite cool and I'd be quite pleased to show my kids at some point. But for me, it was the anxiety of never knowing what was coming next. And like, you never know what they've got in store for you. And you guys saw us doing the challenges and the tasks, but you quite often run 5K to it, or they'd quite often make you run up a hill and say, run to Aunt Middleton. And then as soon as you get to Aunt Middleton, he'd move. And so it was that whole thing of you never know what's going to happen. And that's what I found the hardest.
So quite a lot is cut then from what the viewer actually sees in each programme each week.
I think the viewer probably sees 10% of what goes on. And that's not a criticism of the programme. Like, the people who make that programme are amazing. Like, I've been making telly programmes for, you know, 15 years. And the crew on that are as fit as the contestants, because they're chasing after us with kit and trying to film us. And they're going off cliffs with ropes filming us. So the production's amazing, but because so much happens in that time, you only see as a viewer 10% of it.
Okay, so we only saw 10%, and that 10% looked utterly brutal, terrifying. And let's just talk about the physicality of it, because there you are, and I don't know how much you weigh, but you're not, you know, you're not 12 stone and a boxer, are you? And you're lifting people on your shoulders. I mean, it's just, you know, that is really hard.
I had to carry Brendan, and obviously he's not as heavy as Tony, but he's so tall that he was so awkward to carry. But God love Brendan. I mean, he was the best team player ever, and he was going, right, Helen, you need to hold me like this and do this, because obviously he's a dancer, so he knew how he should get on my back so that I had the best chance of carrying him. Yeah, the physicality is brutal, but things like, I think we all know that if you have a good night's sleep, you can cope with anything, but you never get a full night's sleep there, because what you don't see is we have to go on watchtower every night. So every night you stand on the top of a watchtower just on survey.
No.
In pairs. So you do 2 hours, then you swap, then you do 2 hours and you swap. So you never sleep for more than 2 hours, because you've got to get up, pack up your sleeping bag, pack up your Bergen, climb the watchtower, stand up there in November in 3 a.m. and all that.
And so how long are you there for in total?
The others all went 36 hours before me, but because my kids are so little, I wanted to go as late as possible. So I sort of went straight up there and went straight into it. And in total, I was there 9 days.
And how much training did you do for it? Because presumably you knew a bit about what you might be asked to do.
Yeah, and actually, and people think this is kind of me making an excuse, but I trained a lot with the kids. So I'd had a really... In my kind of work, you're busy for a month and then you're off for a month and you're busy for a month and off for a month. But I was the busiest month of the year leading up to it. But I trained a lot with the kids. Like, I'd walk to school with one on my shoulders and one on my back. And as it turned out, that was the best training ever, because I had hardly done any gym work. I trained a bit at David Lloyd's, and the guy there who watched the series loved it. And he was like, do a bit of this, do a bit of that. But I trained outside a lot, went on a lot of hill walks. I'm from the Lake District, so I love that sort of thing anyway. But trained with a backpack, used to walk up Otley Shevin. And what was funny, when we got there, all the young guns, because they're all 10 years younger than me, were all going on about how many sessions they did a day. And straight away, thought, oh, I'm going to be the weakest here. But very quickly, I was like, no, I think I'm going to be all right.
Watching you in the final, where did you get that ability? Because Louise and I have chatted about this, and we've both concluded that there is no way we would have been able to tolerate someone shouting at us the way you were shouted at. We would have, like, yeah, kind of slightly lost the plot. But I was interested in the look on your face, because it was very serene. It was this slight smile, but not too much. And you just kept looking forward and you just kept taking what they were giving you, and you didn't crack. I mean, how on earth did you do that?
I think my downfall, or maybe the thing that kept me in there, was that I've always sort of thought you either smile or you either laugh or you cry. And I've always felt like that. Like, in anything that's difficult, I've always thought, oh, you either laugh or you cry. And I quite often got the smirks and got the giggles, because that's just my way of coping, which, I mean, I do not advise that anybody do that, because that is not a way to win Aunt Middleton over. Like, at one point, they gave us this big rabbling speech about, right, this is going to get worse, this is going to get awful, this is going to be teams, this is going to separate the wheat from the chaff and all this. And I was convinced they were going to do boys versus girls. And so I couldn't contain my giggling, and they pulled me to one side and they're like, what's so funny? And I was just like, I was just waiting for them to pitch, like, Tony against Lauren and me against Lockie and all that. But I think in the interrogation, you've going through such a horrible situation with the noises, which are deafening, and the stress positions, which are awful. that by the time you get to the interrogation, it's almost like light relief because it's a break from the noises. So it's horrible, but also you're kind of thinking, if I'm putting up with that, I can get through this. This is just a conversation.
So the water exercise, that I have to say, looked pretty horrific. So it was where you were lined up and you had to get into the water and for 5 minutes dunk under the water and come back up again, didn't you, holding your breath?
So you had your hands cable tied together and they said, get in, and you sink down and jump up and sink down and jump up. Now, this is when the tiredness effect creeps in. I go outdoor swimming. Like I joined the Leeds Bradford Triathlon Group. I go to Otley Lake and I swim. So I thought, if you'd asked me before, I would have thought I'd be absolutely fine with that. But when we got there, I was like, oh, I don't want to do this. And as soon as you say that, that's it. They're all on you. So they're like, get in. So they cable tied my hands, got in. I couldn't really do it, but I did it in this. It's just the trouble. As soon as I got out, once they've spotted a crack, they're into you. So like, oh, that was terrible. You did it wrong. And it's that whole confidence thing. It's to see how you react.
And how cold was the water, Helen? Because it looked bloody freezing.
Yeah, I mean, it was November in the Scottish Highlands.
So what temperatures are we talking about? I mean, it's got to be single, very low figures, just about, hasn't it?
I mean, from about 8 or 7, I don't know. Yeah. Around, it wasn't good.
Honestly, I'm absolutely staggered by watching it, to be honest with you. You say you learned that it's okay not to be first, but you must have learned. I mean, the stuff you went through must give you a kind of a little pocket in your brain of resilience, which you will be able to use for the rest of your life.
But if I cast my mind back to the hardest things that I've done, the hardest thing I ever did was the Namibian ultramarathon. So I'm not a runner, but I signed up to do these 80 miles in the desert in 24 hours. And the physical and mental pain of that was, I mean, I was hallucinating. My blisters were so bad. Every time I put my feet on the ground, it was like stepping on razor blades. It was the worst, most horrific thing ever. But I remember what kept me going was one of the doctors on the crew came along and went, oh, well, you've got further than we thought. And I found out that the production crew had all put a bet on when I'd drop out. Not if I'd finish, when I'd drop out. So that was the best thing ever because it made me then lick on and finish. But it was the worst. It was awful. Like, I was literally crying with every step that I took. Even when I watch it now on YouTube, I cry because it's so awful. And that was my reference point. And I kept thinking on SAS, if I get to that bad, that's when I'll hand in my number. And the time when I did get, the one time I thought I'd have to hand in my number was carrying the kayak up the hill because it was so physically painful. And when you fell to the floor, you couldn't get up. Like, you literally could not get off your knees because it was so physically painful to get up off your knees because it was so heavy. And that was the point when I thought, if I can get to the top of this hill, I can cope with anything.
And you did.
And I think probably, like, I mean, you guys must have the same mindset, otherwise you wouldn't do what you do, in that sometimes challenges are good training for life. Like, life throws all kinds of stuff that you don't want to deal with. You know, we're all women of a certain age who've been through relationships and children and job stuff and life stuff. And bad stuff happens that breaks your heart and breaks your mind. And I think challenging yourself makes you know you can cope with it.
Yeah. And what about now? So you got the boys. What about now? Do you focus on kind of getting out and doing your own exercise, or how do you deal with it?
Since lockdown, I have exercise more with the boys. So before, when they were at school, then I'd go for a run or go to the gym or whatever. But because obviously everyone's only been allowed to go out once a day, obviously I don't feel like I could say to the kids, you stay in, I'm going out for a run. So yeah, I've been doing a lot with the kids. But for me, I've used gym since 15. My brother plays football. I've always been brought up in a sporty family. But for me, I don't go to the gym to make my bum peachy. I go to make my head peachy. Like, sport and fitness has always been about how it makes me feel. If I'm stressy or aggy, my husband will be like, oh, just go for a run. At the minute, I'm trying to I'm just doing loads of kitchen discos with the kids. So I never have a routine because I feel like then it's a chore.
I mean, I love that, don't you, Lou? She doesn't go to the gym to make her bum peachy. She goes...
Look peachy.
Yeah, so she goes to the gym to make her brain, her head peachy. I like that one.
I think we might have that as our byline, because that's exactly what we've been talking about over the last 10 weeks or so, isn't it, Annie? How it makes you feel, but not how it makes you look.
Helen is just someone, Lou, that I would just like to sit down and have
a glass of fizz with and talk to her, because she's so much fun but hugely inspiring.
She's definitely in our gang, isn't
she?
She's
in our gang. But you know, the next guest too, I think, is in her gang, and she's another amazing guest that I would also love to sit down and have a glass of wine with. It's Naga Manchetti.
Just take us back a little bit. You've been learning to swim, haven't you?
Yeah, I am. So I was a rubbish swimmer at school. I hated it. Absolutely. For so many reasons, I hated swimming. I hate the cold. So I hate getting into a cold bath, basically. Why would you do that? It's dirty in my head. Skin flakes, people who pee in pools. Why do I want to get into a pool?
Everybody listening is going to think, yeah, she's got some very good points there.
No, seriously, come on. It's a good point. And I just hate it. And also there was that thing, wasn't there, when you're a kid and, you know, you're prepubescent or you're going through puberty and you're exposed in like a little swimming costume and you're really conscious. And I just hated everything about it. And, you know, those days when you were learning to swim, it was you were thrown in, and there were always the kids that had been taken swimming by their parents. And I never had been. And my parents don't swim very well. And it's like my mum learned to swim when she was an adult. I hated every minute of it. I remember I got my 50 meters and I did it all on my back. I could only swim on my back. And I remember I cheated. I did actually touch the side. I kept right next to the side all along. And I'm really good at sculling. And so I think I probably sculled most of it, because every time I flung my arms back, I either hit myself in the head or like had a mouthful of water, and I hated it. So now I can do front crawl and I'm quite elegant. Biggest compliment I got was from one of the teachers who was teaching James while Holly was teaching me. Who said that if I was younger, she'd got me into synchronized swimming because I'm a pretty swimmer.
And yeah. So, Naga, when you were growing up, what was your relationship like with sport? Did you do a lot of sport as a kid? Or other sports, obviously, other than swimming?
My relationship with sport was pretty bad, if I'm being honest. So I love team sports. I was always good at basketball because I was fast. And I always loved squash because I was fast and I'd always knock myself out. I still do. I have numerous cuts and I have a very bad scar here from when my husband slammed. I did shout obstruction, but he slammed the squash racket into my face and we ended up in A&E. But that's another story.
No, tell us the story. My goodness. So you're playing a competitive game. You've already said you're competitive together.
Always with James and I. It's always competitive. And I shout, and I'm one of those annoying players. I end up with the ball marks on your back because, you know, if you get hit by the ball, you lose the point. But I'm always in the way. So my strengths of playing squash is I'm really fast. Like, I'll get to the ball when you'll think I'll never get there.
Yeah.
And have a really strong backhand. And so I can drive it, and a good serve. So I can drive it along the wall and I can serve back into the back corners. So those are the only strengths I've got. And I run really fast, but I do get in the way. Anyway, so I was in the way and I shouted obstruction because I see, like, you know, he's a strong man. And I'm not going to take all the blame for this. I'm just not going to take all
well,
the blame.
He
for
did hit you.
Years, he hit me and with the forehand, and, you know, that's his strong. And it went smash straight here. So I've got the scar here. And it's been glued. James refused to play squash with me for 3 years. So my relationship with sport, Annie, actually, it's mixed if we say that. But at school, I was really academic and really musical. So, and my parents, Asian parents, they were typical Asian parents. They wanted me to, you know, be a doctor or a lawyer. So I was never going to follow music. I was a grade 8 musician with the trumpet and piano. Used to go to a Saturday music school, la la la. So, and the holidays playing an orchestra and la la la. So loved all of that. Really academic, one of those annoying academic kids. So when cross country came up, you know, every term you have like a couple of PE lessons and they switch. Cross country would come up. And you two will be appalled by this because you're pure of body and mind and spirit and all of that.
Oh my God, so not
true.
I would do the cross country run. But I would be one of those kids that did the shortcut, had a fag, and then ran in.
God,
that was me.
Yeah, right? I didn't do that. You didn't do that, Annie, did you?
I know.
I didn't do that.
So that would be me when I was a kid. And then basketball I loved because it was a team sport, and I love team sports, absolutely love them. And then squash, when we got to play squash, that was the thing that I really loved as well.
So moving a little bit away from sport and what you both do as a job. And, you know, obviously I've done commentary work and presenting work, but it's nothing like on the level that you guys are on. I think probably one of the biggest jobs I have is when I was doing the Olympic Games in 2016 with Jonathan Edwards. And I was on camera for a good hour or so before the race. And, you know, there's about 6 million people watching you, which I remember thinking about it. On the way down to the race and then just thinking, I think I'm going to throw up. I don't think I can cope with this. And another story, but I saw something that made me change the way I was thinking. But you girls do this every day of the week. Well, you do three, don't you, Lou? You're on three mornings and you're on the sofa the other 3 mornings.
Mm, yeah.
And I just think, how do you deal with that? You know, it's a bloody tough world because you're constantly up against, you know, all sorts of criticism, you know, and social media has given people such a huge platform to, you know, at times voice brilliant stuff, but a lot of the time, you know, voice some pretty rubbish stuff too.
Shall I go first, Nagi? Because I think I think we have different answers to this.
We do. We do, don't we? Different approaches.
Exactly. Yeah. So my answer to that is literally shut my ears, close my eyes and let the storm pass, Annie, because, and I've written about it a bit as well, you know, it can be hurtful, etc. And I just think, just let it go. Naga, you're really different to me and you engage in it. And I totally admire the way you do that, but that's not what I choose to do.
So what I'd say is, it's interesting you were talking about your experience, Annie, because I've never been nervous going on air, doing any interview. And I'm sure Lou will agree with me in this. It's not because it partly is your comfort zone, but also if you're prepared, the only reason to be nervous is if you don't know your stuff, if you haven't prepared, if you haven't done everything you can to make sure you have the answers and you've done your side of the, you've upheld your side of the bargain, so to speak, you've done your work. So that takes nervousness out of it. When you talk about the storm, I hate injustice. I get so angry if people aren't fair. I have no issue with being criticised. I will be told off by my boss for doing something doing something wrong. Absolutely not a problem. I don't mind if on social media there's constructive criticism. I feel you didn't ask this question. I feel you didn't push that hard enough. And I'll look at it. That's fine. When someone abuses me, I'm going to come back at them with two barrels. I'm just not having it. That is not, I am not there to be abused while I'm doing my job. Funnily enough, Lou, Bill Turnbull said this to me. You know, what we do on air and what footballers do, they're the two jobs where people think they can abuse us while we're doing our jobs. Not after we've done our jobs, while we are doing our jobs. And we're exposed to that. And I'm not having it. I find it very interesting at the moment, actually, during lockdown. People are so polarized. I mean, they're frustrated. Life is hard for a lot of people for many, many reasons. And people are scared. People are fearful about what's going to happen and don't know what's happening. But I do find that people are sometimes just become a little bit more angry during lockdown, particularly about, you know, which way it goes. Are you in support of it? Are you not in support of it? And every political interview I do now for the last 5 weeks, I've trended on Twitter, and I'm like, what's that? And I'd be told, oh, Nagi, you're trending. And you see, and there's more reason, it's not just because I'm a news presenter or a news journalist. There are other reasons. I'm female. I'm not white. You know, I voice an opinion.
You're wearing particular shoes.
Oh, for crying out loud. Yes. You know, and I don't apologize for challenging or, you know, and I'm not as likable. So there are many, many reasons, but I do find, yeah.
I think what's interesting there is, you know, something that will relate to women is if you try too hard to be liked or keep everyone happy, it's not going to work in whichever industry you're working on. I think I've always had this thing, I don't want to upset someone, you know. I mean, so on one hand, I'm a bit of a contradiction because I'm quite hard on one side, but on another side, I just think, oh, I just want people to like me. And I think certainly, you know, I think you manage it really well, Lou, and your approach, Naga, is really different, but both work really well. So
and the one
we
thing
can learn from
that I've learned from my husband is he said to me, look, if you walked into a room and there are 100 people, there is no way 100 people are going to like you. So there's a sort of a sense of acceptance, isn't there? You know, that's the reality. I mean, you know, let's put not put numbers on it, but you would be, you wouldn't be, you know, you'd be very strange if some, or you'd be an amazing person or something. There'd be something very special about it. But it goes, yeah, totally love that person. So that's just reality, isn't it?
I have a slightly different attitude because I've never expected people to like me. I do think I am very, I'm a grower. Like most of my friends would probably say, yeah, I wasn't sure about you at first, you know, and then intensely loyal and brilliant friends now. And I accept that, but I don't expect people to like me. I genuinely don't care if people don't like me.
Annie, I just want to pick up that thought that you introduced Naga with. I mean, the thought of you and her on a night out in the town. I mean, I tell you what, I'd be going home at 8 o'clock. So we love speaking. I love talking to Naga because also, you know, I don't get too much. I do talk to her and I'm probably every couple of weeks or so we're in touch. But, you know, I don't get to spend a lot of time with her because obviously we're on the sofa mostly at different times. Actually, sometimes at Christmas we're on the sofa together, but not this year. So let's talk about Stacey Copeland. She's inspired me, actually, and I haven't done it yet, but I do want to go and try at some point a little bit of boxing. I've never tried it in my life, but listen to her because she's got a great story to tell.
My dad was a boxer. My granddad ran our boxing gym. Me and my dad watched Rocky like it was a documentary. I mean, I thought Rocky was real and it was, you know, we absolutely loved it and we'd watch it. And then, you know, we'd be sort of sparring afterwards in the, you know, I'd always have to be Apollo and we'd have the fight and everything. And I just loved it. I loved everything about the boxing gym, even though they stink, they're dead smelly. But I loved it. I loved the sounds, the sights, the camaraderie, the banter, the whole lot. And when it came to the age of, you know, when you can usually box, which is about 11, you know, me and my little lad mates who had all kind of come through together went to see my granddad and were like, oh, ready to box, ready to box. And he said, oh, you can't box, kid. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, oh, it's illegal for females. And I just couldn't believe I wouldn't get to do the sport that I love. You know, despite the barriers that were there, I continued to do it. And thank God I did. And the sad thing is loads of kids don't. And that's why I do what I do. And I try and be a voice for it because people should be able to pursue what they're passionate about.
So, Stacey, I mean, a couple of things there. And, you know, the fact that boxing was illegal, it kind of all those things always make me laugh. And I tell you why they make me laugh, because I think physically there is nothing tougher in the world than giving birth. I mean, thankfully things have changed, but it has been a slow process and we're not, we could argue, totally there yet.
I think part of the problem why it's taken so long for women's sport as well as women's boxing to progress is because we've been lied to for a very, very long time. And I grew up with those lies that women are not as good, we're inferior, we're the other, we're less than, nobody wants to watch it, nobody's interested in it, we'll never be any good, and sport isn't for us. Those are all lies that I believed growing up, despite loving my sport, despite committing to my sport, despite being around incredibly talented young women and older women in football, boxing and other sports. I believed that narrative because that's what society told me. On an individual level, you know, my experience was being called shim and shemale and boy. People's understanding was that if I wanted to do boys sports, I must therefore want to be a boy. And as a wider society, it was those messages that it wasn't a place where we belonged. Those are all lies. None of that's true. You know, we didn't let women run at one time because they said we'd get big legs, hairy chest and our uterus would fall out. And like to your point, Annie, how ridiculous that nobody ever stopped and said, well, we actually pass an entire human being through that area and no other stuff drops out, so surely we'll be all good to go running. You know what I mean? How ridiculous. But these are the lies that we've been told and people have believed them. We're at the stage now where we're still breaking those lies down and discovering actually women are phenomenal at running, especially endurance running. We are absolutely incredible at it, and it's no surprise given all the other things that we're great at. So I think it's the reason it's taking so long is because we've been told a big massive lie and now we're starting to realise it just wasn't true.
How old are you, Stacey?
38.
So 38, you see, I'm quite a bit older than you, and I'm genuinely sort of still listening to you, kind of shocked that even, you know, somebody who's a lot younger than me, that still has affected you in a big way, actually. I mean, you've got through it, you've done incredible stuff, but it did affect you.
Massively. I spent years, honestly, Louise, years and years thinking, what's wrong with me? There must be something wrong with me. Is it either that I want to be a boy or am I trapped in the wrong body? What's wrong with me? Actually, there was nothing wrong with me. It's just that, you know, society wasn't ready for me and other women like me. And the really sad thing and what motivates me every single day is that, you know, usually we have kids come in the gym, you know, if the parents contact me and say, oh, can you give us some advice about boxing? I say, I'll bring them in and they watch a session and we do pads with them afterwards or whatever. We haven't been able to do that in lockdown. So I've done a lot of Zoom calls with young boxers. And I did one with a 12-year-old and her mum the other week. And she's 12, she's a goalkeeper, absolutely loves her football, like already thinking about going to America and doing some of the things I've done. And she, on a daily basis, is getting called names and being put down, people questioning their sexuality, as they used to do with me and still do now. And it's just really sad to me that kids are still facing this. And there's a stigma that boys face as well. You know, I get messages from parents whose, you know, sons love ballet or they might want to be a nurse, and they face stigma because they're, you know, challenging society's definition of masculinity, as I challenge femininity. And that's why boxing is one of the last stands in that, because it really does challenge our definition of femininity. And that's why it's taking so long. But yeah, that's what motivates me every day, because it's still happening and it's not good enough. People should be able to pursue what they love and what they're passionate about, regardless of gender and stereotypes. Well, I just believe deeply, deeply that sport is one of the most powerful things on the planet for bringing about positive change. And what happens in sport, the progress, whether it's for the LGBT community, race, gender, disability, whatever it is, manifests in other areas of society. That is why it's so important. It can reach people in ways that other things can't. So I think it's really crucial. And I've been privileged to have a passion for sport all my life, and seen, you know, when I've been to the refugee camps and done sport with children, when I've done community projects, you know, in my own city and in our country, I see what it does.
How much, I mean, you get lots of, you were talking a little bit earlier about getting young people into your gym. Do you see it just turn their lives around sometimes?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, sometimes you don't see it straight away, do you? It's something later on. But I think one of the other things is speaking to people at the other end of the careers, you know, those who, when you get chatted to everyday people at these talks that I do or events that I'm at, and they'll say, oh, I did this as a kid and I did that as a kid. And it might not have been the elite level anywhere near it, but they've got this vivid memory of when they had that mentor who was a coach, or these teammates who were a big part of the life, or this purpose that it gave them. And it might not have been, you know, something they ended up doing, but it still really impacted them. So we know what it can do for people. And sometimes it's not till later that they draw on those experiences and that it can have a big impact in their life. But, you know, the sooner we can sort of introduce it to young people, the better. Because, I mean, everything that I've got out of it, how can I not want to pass that on and pay that forward to others, as many have done for me?
Stacey, when we kind of look at what's gone on in the last few months in this country. There's a message here from Holly, actually. COVID-19 has had a dramatic impact on women, with only 30% being active enough for a health benefit. You know, how do we change this within society? I mean, you and me and Louise, we're all incredibly passionate. We understand the, you know, the real benefits of being active. But how do we change, I guess, the opinion of others and motivate people enough to do something to make change?
I think one of the things for lockdown is, and I've felt this since the beginning, and I do still work in a school one day a week. And I mean, I'm involved in lots of things that I'm passionate about. So, you know, I have sport, I have the radio, I have my public speaking, I have the charity, but I also do a job in a school. And so I'm involved with lots of different people from all walks of life. And I think when I was hearing people say at the beginning, we're all in the same boat, that wasn't true. We're in the same storm, but we're all in very, very different boats. And I was seeing a lot of really positive stuff about families being out on bikes, people assembling these incredible weight benches and little mini multi-gym stations in the gardens and doing these incredible online sessions in the homes. And that's brilliant. That's absolutely brilliant. People going out walking, accessing nature, you know, doing far more than they've ever had a chance to do, which is great. Then there's another totally different demographic of people like my sister, who's got two children, she's trying to work from home and juggling all of that. It's very, very difficult to then get on a bike, leave your kids at home. And, you know, so we've got single parents, we've got people who, you know, also still, because of traditional gender roles, although women are working from home or not, still a massive amount of childcare, you know, looking after the home, cleaning, cooking and all that still is put on and expected, you know, by women. And so there's that aspect as well. And then there's, you know, there's economics that, you know, some people are in a very, very small confined space in a flat with lots of children. Lots of my families, the children I work with at school, have not got adequate housing. They're not provided for properly. And to then get internet and be jumping up and down in a high-rise flat doing exercises and buying bikes for the whole family is just not possible. So I think there's a lot of reasons why. And that's the problem sometimes with statistics. It's not that women don't want to. It's maybe there's a lot of barriers that not all women face and not all men face. And so I think there's not one who. It's maybe there's a lot of barriers that not all women face and not all men face. And so I think there's a lot to look at of how we help different demographics access sport and activity.
I want to talk to you about so many things. So let's move on to boxing. So you started boxing. I mean, I have never boxed in my life, ever. So just explain to you, start right from the beginning. It's for me to hit someone is a big deal.
Absolutely. And it's a very odd sport, without a doubt. It's a very strange sport. It's not a nice, pleasant sport. God knows why some of us love it, but then.
No, I can see why you do. I'm not saying that at all.
No, it is a straight, it's great for fitness.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. But to compete is strange, and it's at odds with, you know, like when you first start, being hit is also odd because it's, you know, and you kind of have to transfer it from the outside. It seems like hitting someone and someone hitting you.
Yeah.
To a boxer, there's a technical, skillful element to it of you've landed that punch because your footwork was in place, your timing was good, your technique was good. So you're kind of looking at it through a skill lens as opposed to just hitting someone. So it's kind of a different mentality, but it does take a while to get into that when you start.
And also to that point, when you say being hit as well, because if somebody hit me, I would just feel rage.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think for me, I mean, I was learning from being a little kid, so it was kind of second nature to me. And you learn all the basics and then you start sparring. And when you get hit, all you think is, oh, what did I not do then? What was I not covering up? Or why did I leave a gap? Or what did I not do defensively? And you're thinking, how can I get that point back? I need to get that point back. The judges will have seen that, you know, or what will my coach think or whatever. So you are thinking technically, you know, from a skill and sport. And boxing's so difficult. Like when anyone tries it, there's so much to think about. For a start, you're trying to breathe because your heart rate's like, you know, really high for the whole 2 or 3 minute round. You're thinking about your footwork, your movement, where you are in the ring, you know, how you're going to sort of go at the opponent, how you're going to defend yourself, and all while you're trying to breathe. You know, it's a lot to take in. So it's, it doesn't feel like hitting and being hit, really. There's so much technicality to it that you're focused on that more.
I've got a couple of questions for you, Stacey, that I want to put to you. And this is from Lisa. And this is a question I wanted to ask anyway. And she talks about, you know, women in boxing have had to fight a long, hard battle for equality in professional boxing, despite the presence of women and girls in boxing across the country for years. She says it's really encouraging to see women like you break through into the professional scene. What advice do you give to people who fancy training at entry level, both women and girls?
My view of this has completely changed over the years. I used to think that if you weren't going to compete, you shouldn't go in a boxing gym. But that's because I'd been raised in the time when you didn't go in a boxing gym unless you were a boxer. You didn't have this, you know, you've been at the office all day and then you want to go and punch a bag. It just didn't really happen. It was much later that came here. Now I think it's a fantastic thing and a massive advocate for it because I think boxing is a brilliant form of training. And because there's so much to think about, you kind of, like all the ladies that come to our class, you know, a lot of them have got a lot of difficult situations, are single parents, two are carers, one's a carer for a husband who's got severe mental health issues. There's loads of things going on and loads of demands on them. And then they get to come for 1 hour a week and just, you know, while they're that busy thinking, right, jab, backhand, hook, duck, oh, what am I doing? They can't think of all that other stuff because they're in the moment. And that's one of the beautiful things that sport gives you at every level. It can be entry level or it can be an Olympian and you have to be in the moment to do it well and commit yourself to it. And that's a great thing. So I would encourage anybody to go and try a variety of gyms because it's important to feel comfortable. If the first one you go to, not for you, fine, try a different one. And then just to, you know, just to do it with people who you feel comfortable with and to enjoy it. And if you really want to commit to it, for those who want to compete, then really try and be the very best you can be, because it's really important as women in every sport that we really, you know, if we're going to put ourselves out there and commit, that we change perceptions by being good.
And just a reminder, of course, this is our review of the year. We've had so many guests. We haven't got time to mention them all, Annie. But if anybody wants to listen to their podcast, the whole of their podcast again, or any of the other ones, do please subscribe. That's what you do, isn't it? And go back and have a good listen to them all. They'll get you through running, ironing, whatever it is. And do leave us a review as well. We've loved our reviews. So that's it for our second review of the year. We've just got one more to go, Annie, and then we'll be back into 2021. What an excitement.
I can't wait, Lou. I've got one question for you. Have you finished your Christmas shopping?
No.
I haven't even started mine. We better get going.
Haven't you started?
No.
I had, obviously, having been resident of my sofa at home for several weeks, I have started, but I've never, you know, it's kind of never done until the day, to be honest with you, from my point of view. And I always do the wrapping on Christmas Eve, really late into the evening, which is so annoying.
So do I. Every time you're there, right? You just go, oh my God, I've got 5 hours of wrapping and it's 8 o'clock.
Exactly. And I'm running out of sellotape. Yeah. Buy some sellotape. That's what we should do. See you next
time.
Hi, my name's Mel Berry and I'm one of the co-founders of Her Spirit. I hope you've enjoyed today's podcast. These podcasts would not have been made possible without the support of the brilliant MediChecks. MediChecks offer an easy and affordable way to check your health with their simple and personalised blood tests. From hormones and nutrition to cholesterol and diabetes, there is something for everyone. Just go to MediChecks.com to find out more. Have a great day.